and welcome to Go Nuts, the monthly podcast of the Northern Nut Growers Association. I'm your host, Gina Zimbardi, and for this month, I thought we would try something a little different. Recently, we've had all of our annual reports and nutshells dating back from the beginning, 1910, indexed as readable and searchable PDFs. These are actually available on our website at nutgrowing.org. I've been reading through some of these nutshells. This month, I'd like to take a reading from the 1916 annual report that talks about the importance of nut culture. Enjoy and go nuts! The Importance of Nut Growing, H. W. Collingwood, New Jersey. Read from the Northern Nut Growers Association report of the 8th Annual Meeting from Stamford, Connecticut, September 5th and 6th, 1916. In these days, the importance of most things is valued in figures. I never was good at figures. It seems to me that you can do anything you like with figures, except make them more clear. Yet it was the failure to figure that gave me my first idea of the importance of nut culture. Some 50 years ago, a small boy on a New England farm could not, or would not, do his sums in the old Coburn arithmetic. It made no difference that the teacher called it mathematics, and pointed it with the end of a hickory stick. By any other name, it was not sweet. This boy got stuck on a question about a hare and a hound. It appeared that the hare jumped a rod at a time and made 33 jumps a minute. The hound started 200 feet behind the hare. This hound made 18 feet at a jump and made 32 and a half jumps a minute. Now, would the hound catch the hare before they got to a hickory half a mile away? I am glad they introduced that hickory tree because the question was a hard nut at best and needed brain food. I couldn't tell where the hare would be, and I can't now. Nor do I believe that some of you wise heads, grown hairless with constant thinking, could really tell how the hare came out. If I saw one of my children headed for me with such a problem in hand, I confess that I should make a prompt engagement outside. The old folks who brought me up had sterner ways of enforcing education. They decided that the boy should live on brown bread and water until he did that example. In order to assist hunger in bringing the boy to it, after the first day showed that the boy was still going, the old gentleman hunted up all the axes and hatchets, scythes and knives on the place, and made the boy turn grindstone while he held the implements on. Greek met Greek. The boy wouldn't give in, and the old man couldn't in preserve his dignity. But try as he might, the old man could not tire out the boy. The old hands gave out first. And the old man straightened his back and gazed at the wonderful boy. Now, it wasn't in brown bread and water to sustain strength and will in that way. Not when there are baked beans for supper, and you could smell them. The old man had to acknowledge a higher power which beat him. He wouldn't do it openly. That was not the New England way. But he did it on the second night by helping the boy to bake beans and fried potatoes without a word. The old man went to his death thinking that he had a most wonderful boy, and that little fellow did not give a secret away. Now, we may have it as a slight contribution to the importance of nut culture. The sustaining power which carried the boy through his trial was the hickory nut. There was a pile of them in the attic, and the boy, on the quiet, cracked and ate a quart of them every day. That boy could not spell protein to save his life, and carbohydrates would have scared him off the floor. But the nuts and the brown bread gave him a balanced ration which did everything except find out about the hound and the hare. I think it would have required a balanced ration fed to an unbalanced brain to settle that problem. Now, I think that the importance of the nut industry must come to the general public in that way, through the stomach rather than through the mind. The human mind is a marvelous piece of mental machinery. So is the machine which sets types or weaves fine cloth. Yet both are powerless unless the fire pot under the engine, or the stomach of the man, are kept filled with fuel or food. I have heard very old men tell of the prejudice which existed against coal years ago in New England, when attempts were made to introduce the new fuel. Cordwood was the local fuel. People knew what it was, and its preparation provided a local industry. The introduction of coal meant destruction for this local business of woodcutting and wiped out the value of many a farm. Coal had to win its way against prejudice and local interest, and it only won out by showing power. I am sure that 75 years ago, if some visionary Yankee had said that coal would be so freely used in New England that cordwood would be almost unsellable, the public would surely have given him the honorary title, which goes with perspective and persistent knowledge, nut. In like manner, the importance of nut growing will not truly be recognized until we can show a man in the most practical way that nuts provide the energy to be found in beefsteak. It is said that knowledge creates an atmosphere in which prejudice cannot live. I know an old man who is absolutely settled in his conviction that New England has degenerated because her people have given up eating baked beans and codfish balls and introduced the sale of these delicacies in the West. That man says, with convincing logic, that in the old days, when New England lived on brown bread and baked beans, we produced statesmen on every rocky hillside, and we dominated the thought of the nation. Now, he says, we have not developed one single statesman since the canned baked bean industry took our specialty away from us. The only way to convince him is to produce a dozen statesmen out of men who are willing to subscribe to the diet of nuts. I have a friend who says he feels like throwing a brick every time he passes a modern laundry. He says the invention of the linen collar kept him a poor man. His grandfather invested the family fortune in the stock of paper collar factory. Many of our older men remember the time when we all wore paper collars and bought them by the dozen in boxes. It seemed like a sure thing when the old man put all of his money into it. He figured that by 1915 there would be 40,000 people in this country, each one wearing at least 200 paper collars a year. Something like the hound and the hare, perhaps, but he didn't know that the hare in this case would drop dead, and the hound double his jump, as happened to paper and linen collars. Someone invented the modern linen collar. The laundry service started up, and paper collars disappeared with the family fortune. Now, my friend must work for a living and throw mental bricks at the laundry. In a way, every new habit or every new interference with the thought and method of the plain people must run the gauntlet and submit to just such violent changes. Now, the future of the nut business, which contains the importance of the industry, depends upon our ability to make the plain, common people understand that in the future we must cut our beefsteak and our chops off a nut tree. We have made some of the brainy people understand this already, but the hound is still chasing the hare, and he is several jumps behind. You may say what you will or think as highly as you like of your own place in society, but the world is not run or pushed by the brainy people. They may steer it for a while and master it, but only at the permission of what I may call the stomach of the people, who always, sooner or later, rise up and dominate things. A gilt-edged, red-line edition of Nut Knowledge will get the few or select class, but in order to make the industry truly important, we must make a homely appeal to the plain people. It seems to me that one of the most effective nut documents yet issued is the bulletin by George Carver, a colored man of the Tuskegee Institute. Carver simply makes his appeal to the Southern farmer, and he gives him 45 ways of cooking and eating peanuts. I rather think that Carver's work in trying to get the Southern Negroes to eat more peanuts and more cowpeas has done about as much for the race as the academic instruction given in college. On the principle that like begets like, I feel sure that the continued practice of cracking the shell to get at a sweetmeat inside will tend to put more phosphorus and less lime into the skull of the race. I once explained the nut proposition to the energetic man, and he said, "Fine, the theory is perfect. Now hire a man who lives on rare beef to get out and fight for your proposition, and you will put it over." Last year, I went up into New York State with a prominent public man who was to make a speech. This man was delayed, and in order to get there, he had to jump on the last platform of the last car. He had eaten no lunch and only a light breakfast. He said he should fail in his speech because he was faint from lack of food. I'd asked him what he would eat if he had the chance. He said soup, half a chicken, potatoes and asparagus, and apple pie. I told the train boy to bring samples of everything he had, and we finally selected an apple from Oregon, a banana from Mexico, a box of figs from California, some popcorn from Massachusetts, chocolate from Venezuela, and salted nuts from Louisiana. The air and the sunshine and the water seemed to be produced in New York, but nothing else. A great dinner for a New York man, but to his surprise it satisfied him, took the place of the chicken, and carried him through his speech with a strong punch. It seems to me that one trouble with our nut propaganda is that we go at it in such a way that the peoples regard us somewhat as nuts, and why should the man who becomes a specialist on any subject and airs it on all occasions be called a nut? We shall have to admit that men are called such names. I think it is because we let our brains work somewhat like the oyster or clam and secrete a hard shell of formal knowledge around the sweet meat of condensed human nature. For that is what all useful knowledge is. We must crack our shell of formal knowledge and grind it up finer before we can put it into the think works of plain people. While I was working up at Apple Consumers League some years ago, I ran upon the fact that Corbett, the prize fighter, consumed 3 dishes of applesauce every day while training. Now, I had used the statement that J.P. Morgan always had a baked apple for his lunch, but I got small results from that story. Few people ever expected to make millions, and Morgan was out of their class. Every man carried a punch, which he wanted to enlarge to make effective. If Corbett used applesauce to oil his arm for every knockout blow, every man with red blood wanted apples. Now we must work out our nut campaign in such a popular way if we expect to put our nut on the wheel of progress. The fact that Professor Johnson, or Dr. Jackson, or Reverend Thomas, or Judge Dixon, or Senator Harrison find strength and comfort from eating nuts is very important and pleasant. But 99% of our people never expect to enter the learned profession, and they must not get the idea that these professionals stand around the full use of nuts like a barbed wire fence. Most men live and work in the rough and tumble of life, and at present they think that red meat is the sustaining power of that sort of stuff. We must change their point of view. Let us find athletes, baseball men, wrestlers, fighters, runners, men who stand well in popular sports and who will publicly state that they substitute nuts for meat in part at least. We must put this thing into a popular imagination of the plain people if it is to be full importance. When some fellow with a new brand of cigarettes wants to develop a trade among young men, he gets some noted ballplayer to write a letter stating his love for the brand. I think we should follow that plan somewhat in putting our nut campaign before the people. 2 years ago, the Oregon Agricultural College sent a football team east. The college was almost unknown here, but I asked one or two football men about it. They laughed at these Pacific Coast athletes. Here was a college, they said, which had issued a bulletin advising the people to send their children to school with nut sandwiches instead of meat. This man said that such training would only result in puny, half-grown men, and he doubted if this team would last halfway across the country. Those Oregon boys lined up a team of giants. They simply wiped the earth with most teams of their class and left behind the cracked shells of a long line of reputation, with the sweetmeat well picked out. Personally, I believe within 25 years, 50 at the least, our people will be absolutely forced to accept a diet of nuts in place of our present proportion of meat. As I see it, the time is coming when increased population and shortage of available land will make prime beef nearly as scarce as turkey and venison are today. Not only so, but I think knowledge will slowly but surely lead men to change their diet from choice. My children will live to see the time when the acre nut orchard on the average farm will be considered just as useful and as much of a necessity and far more profitable than the present chicken yard. In that day, I think the nut industry will rank in food importance second only to that of corn, and I believe that the greatest change will be found here in New England. For I believe that nut culture is to change history and readjust population and industry to some extent. Frankly, I expect my children to live to see the time when the hickory nut of New England will rank far above the walnut industry in California, or in France. I think this nut culture will, in time, bring a greater income to New England states than all its fruits and grain combined today. Out in the wild woods on some New England hillside, there are growing today strains or variety of nuts, which will do far more for this section than the Baldwin apple or the Bartlett pear have ever done. They will be found, tamed, and propagated. You may, if you like, call me a dreamer, or what is the same thing as a nut. I can stand for that, for I have not, in my short span of life, seen dreams ever come true. Suppose the wandering hunter, or the farmer's boy, who discovered the Baldwin apple in the woods of Massachusetts, had gone back to his house and stated that the time would come when this beautiful red fruit would grow wherever it found suitable climate, that it would revolutionize horticulture, bring millions of dollars to New England, and find its way throughout the world, wherever the sails of commerce are blown. They might have hung him as a witch or a dreamer, and yet his dream would be no more improbable than what I say of nut culture in New England. I have seen the telephone, the flying machine, the gasoline engine, all grown from the vain dream of a crazy inventor to public necessities. And surely as fate, the nut industry is to bring back the old hillsides of New England, much of the profit and the glory of the old days.